few decibels of attenuation at exactly 2 gigahertz. So it's the precession of the magnetic field inside of the Yeatsphere crystal caused by the presence of the steady-state magnetic field from the solenoid magnet that causes the cross-coupling between those two coils. If I now put those two coils, one is the input connector, one is the output connector, I've got a one-pole filter. And by the way, good Yeats filters might usually have 2, 3, 4 poles to them, all in the middle of that magnetic structure. But with the one-pole filter I just described to you, if I now put that back into the feedback circuit of an oscillator, I am forcing the exact frequency of oscillation of that oscillator. The filter passes only that frequency. The oscillator is forced to run at only that frequency. And when you plot the exact center frequency of precession versus the strength of the magnetic field, it is the most linear thing you've ever seen, between 2 and 8 gigahertz. You tell me what it does at 2 gigahertz, I can tell you exactly. You tell me how many milliamp...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You tell me how many milliamperes of current you have to put into the solenoid magnet to make it run at 2 gigahertz. I can tell you exactly how many milliamperes of current you're going to put through that exact same coil in order to operate it at 18 gigahertz. It's going to be exactly 9 times as much because it's a 9-to-1 frequency range. It's the most linear thing in the world, as if it goes through zero. In reality, the oscillator can't go below 1.8 gigs, but above 1.8 gigs, it's the most linear thing in the world, as long as your pole piece magnetic structure doesn't have some other kind of silly magnetic saturation characteristics.
I have a problem with part of this statement. So that is that if the oscillator has 20 megahertz per milliampere tuning sensitivity, then 100 milliampere will tune the oscillator to 2,000 megahertz, which is 2 gigahertz, at 500, and 500 milliamps will provide 10 megahertz. So it looks like the increase of the current changes the frequency of the EEG oscillator, not the generator, and that's it.
No, I didn't say it's moving the generator. It's moving. If that Yeatsphere filter that I just described to you, the one-pole Yeatsphere filter, is in the feedback network of a Yeatsphere-tuned oscillator, by you determining the amount of current into the magnetic solenoid structure, determines the amount of magnetic field, the strength of the magnetic field, determines the exact frequency of precession, let's call it resonance, of the Yeatsphere, which allows the cross-coupling to take place, which allows the, you know, the input coil versus output coil of the RF coil to couple signals, and you're now determining the exact frequency of oscillation of the Yeatsphere oscillator if it is a fundamental Yeatsphere-tuned oscillator. If it's this 0 to 3.5 gig things, which looks like it's a heterodyning, then it's going to obey some very different rules because the actual frequency of oscillation is different than your output frequency. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Into exchange. Another question that I have is, you said one coil and approximately the second coil. The typical main coil, not the secondary coil, the main coil is made of the copper wire and may have 500 to 1,000 turns. Back to you.
Yeah, if you took apart that Yeatsphere oscillator, if it was a fundamental Yeatsphere oscillator on the left-hand side, and you see that there's a 8-sided rectangular-like structure that has the SMA connector on it. You see a cylindrical structure above that. And you can't tell it in the picture, but below that there's an identical cylindrical structure. And if you took apart that cylindrical structure, you would see roughly 500 turns of enameled wire inside of a pole piece. That's the upper one and the lower one. And they are phased together so that the current flowing through one flows through the other. They're in series. The 500 turns of one is in series with the 500 turns of the other. The two of them create an adding magnetic field when those two pole pieces are slammed together inside of an 8-sided structure that's got the SMA connector on it. That is the magnetic field, and the center pole piece, right in the middle of the center pole piece, is where the Yeatsphere sits. So, I wouldn't call it a primary winding. I would call it the magnetic solenoid winding, the thousand turns, as you called it, that creates the strength of the magnetic field. That creates the rate of precession of the Higgs sphere. That creates the frequency of which it passes a signal. Now there are two individual coils of one turn each, the RF coils, at right angles to each other, that are also across that Higgs sphere, inside of that magnetic structure. So RF-wise, you're going input to a one-turn coil, coming out of a one-turn coil, RF-wise, on a Higgs bandpass one-pole filter. And that could be made inside of a Higgs-tuned oscillator. But I think you see the theory of operation if I was making a one-pole Higgs bandpass filter. Over to you, Wes.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The oscillator is housed and designed to focus the magnetic field in a pole gap, and is recopying from the above frequency, the frequency also that is directly proportional to the applied magnetic field. So let's say, to achieve, 2.8 gigahertz, a magnetic field is in approximate of 1,000 gauss that is required. But 2,000 gauss gives me 5.6 gigahertz. Now, I see in here dependency, the stronger the magnetic field, the higher the frequency, but at the same time, it is caused by the current. The stronger the current, the higher the frequency. So let's say, what is first, egg or the chicken? The current caused I have a problem with that. The current caused the increase of magnetic field. The magnetic field caused the change of the frequency. I mean, I have some non-clear situation here.
Most Higgs-tuned oscillators and Higgs-tuned filters have a magnetic pole piece, the thing that's got 1,000 turns, 500 turns in each half of the bell structure, that cylindrical device, and they get slammed together so that there's a small gap on the pole piece in the center. They are made of a solid chunk of steel, not laminated. As such, the main tuning coil can tune that Higgs-tuned oscillator at a moderately slow rate. If you wanted to tune it across 2 to 12 gigahertz, and you wanted to do that 30 times per second, that's about the limit. So in other words, 30 hertz. The actual current and or magnetic field made by the pole piece is making a sawtooth waveform of magnetic field strength versus time, sawtooth waveform, and you're getting 30 of those sawtooth waves per second. You try to go any faster than that, the hysteresis effect of the solid chunk of steel, which is not laminated, will not allow you to go faster. They do put another particular coil in there, an air-tuned coil in the gap, which allows you to do a little bit of tuning at a faster rate, but you can only tune 1 or 2% of the band, so to speak. So the pole piece is only seeing a slowly sweeping, relatively speaking, sweeping magnetic field. The current into the 1,000-turn winding determines the exact amount of magnetic field, and that in turn determines the RF frequency at the gigahertz rates that's going on in the Higgs sphere. None of the gigahertz phenomena gets anywhere near the pole piece or gets anywhere near the 1,000-turn solenoid coil. They're thoroughly separated because...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That solid chunk of steel is the world's strongest low-pass filter. It barely lets you pass 30 hertz. And if you think you're going to put 2 gigahertz through there, I've got a bridge I want to sell you in Brooklyn. N2XJN, K2LIW.
For most applications, the nominal diameter of Higgs spheres is 10 to 30 thousand of an inch. And of course, then the sphere is normally mounted on the road and is becoming Higgs sphere assembly. And due to the ferrite properties of the Higgs spheres, they resonate at microwave frequency when immersed in a magnetic field. Question, what is so special in sphere? And why do they have ferrite properties? Why is the sphere? Why is not any other shape? Back to you.
If it had any other shape, well, let's backtrack. Before you plug the sphere into the structure, you've got these pair of one-turn coils, RF coils. One is the input coil, one's the output coil. And they are made, they are carefully positioned to be exactly at right angles to each other, orthogonal. And you can prove to yourself that you've made them orthogonal by connecting your signal generator to the first coil and measure how much signal comes out of the second coil. And if you're getting 40 decibels of attenuation, you know that those two are orthogonal. You put a piece of magnetic material in between those two right-angled coils, and if you don't position that piece of magnetic material exactly in the geometric center of those two coils, if I position it a little bit too far off to one side, I will create cross-coupling between those coils. Electronically speaking, they are no longer orthogonal. In order to keep them orthogonal, I must have a piece of ferrite material in there which is thoroughly symmetrical to each of those two coils, and the geometric center of that ferrite material must be in the exact geometric center of those two coils. If I don't obey those characteristics, that circuit electronically is no longer orthogonal. In order to keep that orthogonality across the 2 to 12 gigahertz of my particular Yig filter I'm talking to you about right now, to keep that orthogonal from 2 to 12 gigs, I've got to very carefully position that coil exactly in the geometric center, and it must be a thoroughly round device. Otherwise, even though I've got it in the geometric center of coil number 1, if it was a little bit lopsided, it wouldn't be in the geometric center of coil number 2. And there would be cross-coupling between the two that doesn't include the precession phenomena. And I wouldn't be able to tune it as nicely. You see what's going on here? Only a thoroughly round sphere in exactly the right position with exactly the right grain orientation of the crystal structure meets all of these criteria. Into XJN, K2LIW.
Into XJN. So, 100 milliamps tunes the oscillator to 2 gigahertz. 500 milliamps provides 10 gigahertz output frequency. Question, how is the current mechanically affecting mechanical vibration of the sphere to change the frequency instead of simply forcing sphere to higher amplitude of vibration at the same frequency?
The only cross-coupling that takes place between these two right-angle RF coils is the magnetic precession that's going on with inside of the Yig crystal structure. There's a magnetic vector, as if I was pointing my finger straight up, so to speak, and now my finger is going to wave around just like the axis of a spinning top on the floor that a child plays with, and we call that precession. The rate of precession determines the frequency at which the signal is coupled from RF coil number 1 into coil number 2. The magnetic field changes that rate. The magnetic field does not change the deflection of the precession. In other words, the precession is occurring, let's say, a certain number of degrees from zenith. And that certain number of degrees stays there. It's a matter of the crystal structure itself. There's something magic about yttrium, iron, and garnet. When you mix them together the right way, they're going to precess at a certain magnitude of precession. The only thing you can control with the magnetic field is the rate of the precession. The magnetic field being stronger and weaker appears not to change the magnitude of the precession, only the rate of the precession. I don't know how, but that's the way it happens. Another way of explaining it is that even if the stronger magnetic field gave you a greater magnitude of precession, if you already are coupling those two coils together with very little insertion loss, the extra magnitude wouldn't change anything. You're already getting near you know, a very small number of dB. I think the total insertion loss of those two RF coils is something in the vicinity of a couple of tenths of a dB. I vaguely remember that a three-pole filter,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Additional question that I have, would you consider the sphere to be a coupling device between the coils?
That's exactly what it is. It's a pure coupling device between the two coils. Except for the Yeek sphere and the precession, there is no coupling between those two coils.
Okay, the magnetic field is at 90 degrees to the electric field. Now we have two coils at right angle. Now we have a sphere in the middle of it. How then we have the interaction being done? The electric field of one is 90 degrees to the electric field of the other one.
You said electric field. And when you're talking about a fastly changing RF magnetic field, yes, it generates an electric field. I think the majority of the coupling through the Yeek-sphere is purely magnetic. That's my guess. Go ahead.
Whenever we have we're dealing with coil, we're dealing with two factors, the magnetic part and the electric part. Now, both of them at 90 degrees, but we have another coil that is 90 degrees to the first one. So those, the electric component of the first one will be at 90 degrees to the electric component of the second one. I'm trying to picture the decoupling done by sphere.
The signal that you put into the first RF coil creates a magnetic field down the axis of that RF coil. That axis includes the Yeek sphere. If I was plugging a signal into the second RF coil, the current that flows to that second RF coil would create a magnetic field that goes down the axis of the second coil. The magnetic field from the first coil, the magnetic field from the second coil, are at right angles to each other, and the Yeek sphere is in the middle. The Yeek sphere is making a magnetic field that's at right angles to those two. And at first, it doesn't do anything until it precesses. When the magnetic field of the Yeek sphere, which is at right angles to the magnetic fields of coil number one and coil number two, when that Yeek sphere right angle magnetic moment precesses, it is cyclically coupling energy from coil number one magnetically into coil number two magnetically. Over to you, Wes, KQLIW.
Okay, into exchange. So we have two coils. The second coil is quite small when compared to the main coil. Usually has 10 to 15 turns, compared to 1,000 turns, with very low inductance and low resistance. The FM coil allows a much faster tuning rate than the main coil. The FM tuning bandwidth are nominally from mid to the very high kilohertz range, and can be pushed to the low megahertz region. So the sensitivity of FM coil is usually between 300 to 450 kilohertz per milliampere. And the low frequency deviation of the FM port is limited to approximately 100 megahertz due to the limitation of the FM coil wire. Now, question. We have a secondary FM coil that is normally provided to frequency modulate or phase-lock oscillator. Question, what phase-lock oscillator has to do in this particular situation in controlling FM modulator?
The main coil with 1,000 turns in the magnetic pole P structure gives you coarse tuning. That gets you into the right frequency region. If I was building a phase-lock loop signal generator, and I wanted it to operate at 5 gigs, I would put approximately the right amount of current into the 1,000-turn coil. That gets me to oscillate at 5 gigs on this Yeek-tuned oscillator. In that gap of the pole pieces, where the Yeek sphere is located, there's a secondary air coil, a small number of turns. That's not part of the magnetic pole piece. But the magnetic field created by the FM coil, the air coil, is exactly in line with the magnetic field that's made by the main pole piece. The FM coil can add or subtract a small amount of magnetic field of the main pole piece, and it can do it at a megahertz rate, very fast. The main coil can only be tuned at a kilohertz rate. It takes milliseconds to move it. Whereas the FM coil, I can tune things in fractions of a microsecond, maybe even nanoseconds. So the FM coil, the good news is I can move it fast. The bad news is I can only move it a small amount. Well, if I've done a good enough job with the cross-tuning coil, the main coil, to get into the right frequency region, now my phase lock loop circuitry, the fast operating portion of it, feeds current into the FM coil, the air coil, and gets me exactly on frequency and exactly on phase, and keeps me on phase throughout the whole cycle of the reference signal going into the phase lock loop circuit.
This is confusing, this area, and to exchange. Are we dealing with frequency modulation over frequency modulation, where first FM is done by alternating current, and second by changing the current through the first coil, and the second FM is done through the altering frequency of the secondary coil, causing change of the magnetic field from the primary? This is the area of confusion.
You're sort of asking which one can do the FM. And the answer comes back to how far do you want to sweep and how fast. If you want to sweep across the whole damn band, 2 to 12 gigahertz, you do that exclusively with the main coil, but you're going to do it slowly. You're going to take a significant number of milliseconds to scan between 2 and 12 gigs with the main 1,000-turn coil. The FM coil cannot scan you 2 to 12 gigs. It maybe can scan you plus and minus, I'll pick a number, 30 megacycles. The good news is you can scan that one plus or minus 30 megacycles, and you can do it as fast as you like, but you can't do it more than 30 megacycles of FM scan. So you can scan very fast if you're scanning only a small portion of the range. You can scan very far if you're doing it very slowly. So you can't scan across the whole down band rapidly with a Yig-tuned filter You can't do that with a non-laminated core. If you make the core laminated, you now can scan with the main coil fast. That's the good news. The bad news is you give up a tremendous amount of linearity when you do that, because the individual laminations, when you scan with the main coil, if it's a laminated main core, the 1,000-turn core is now laminated, as you scan to higher frequencies and you're making stronger magnetic fields, the individual laminations suck together. They act like somebody has put a vise across them, therefore the total magnetic reluctance of the path changes and the tuning linearity goes down the tubes. It doesn't deviate that fast. It's expensive to make laminated, and you make them and you can scan fast, but now you give up a tremendous amount of linearity when you do that. Like everything else in life, there's trade-offs. You got it, John. KQLIW. Wait for the beep.
KC2WGB. Dick, when you get a chance, could you explain the physical design and how it's done to make it a 3-pole or a 4-pole device?
Yes. In my simple example, I was putting one single Yig sphere dead center between the pole pieces of those two cylindrical objects, in the air gap of the center rod, if you know what I mean, of that pole piece. If you looked at each one of those cups, that cylindrical object, you would see an outer cylinder of steel, a center rod of steel, and in between the two, you'd see 500 turns. Build a pair of them, slap them together, such that the outer cylinders come together edge to edge. The center rod has an air gap of a few thousandths of an inch, where in my example, I put the Yig sphere dead center. Now, let me drop. If I now take a total of 3 or 4 gig spheres and don't put them exactly in the center of the round rod, the air gap, I displace them in a square pattern a little bit off center. But if I'm careful enough to position them correctly, each one of the four spheres sees the exact same magnetic field magnitude. Therefore, they're all tuned to the same frequency simultaneously. Each one of those gig spheres has a pair of right angle, one turn RF coils across them. And now, with the 3 gig spheres, if I made a 3 gig sphere filter, I would have a total of 6 of those one turn coils. Each pair of them is across 1 gig sphere at right angles. And I have the inner of the 6 coils, I have the inner 5 connected to each other just right, if you know what I mean. The signal flows into coil number 1, one turn coil number 1, across gig sphere number 1, out of the output coil of gig sphere number 1, into the input coil of gig sphere number 2, and so on. They're cascaded. And a three-pole filter, with good design, I think it can have something like 1 or 1.5 dB of total insertion loss. Each individual gig sphere pair of coils gets something like 0.5 dB of loss at the resonant frequency. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
And what is the benefit of having the 3 gig sphere devices within one?
A 3-pole filter gives you a much steeper set of skirts than you get out of a 1-pole filter. A 1-pole filter, plus or minus 30 megacycles, I may only be 10 dB down, 20 dB down. A 3-pole filter, plus or minus 10 megacycles, I can be 60 dB down. The dBs on the skirts add. So putting 3 poles together, cascaded like this, as opposed to 1, gives me a nice-looking, beautiful bandpass filter. If I tune it just right, I can have a rectangular bandpass with sharp skirts that looks just like a Chebyshev 3-pole filter. Over to you, John.
Hey, Dick, fully understood. Very good. I was just wondering. All right, pick up question.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, point number 2 was the, what is the dielectric thermal analysis, DETA, which stands for dielectric thermal analysis. Well, is the dielectric analysis, that's the analysis of the impedance properties of the material in temperature between 180 degrees and 600 degrees of Celsius. And the reason that I have mentioned that is because it is differing from the HP parallel plate capacitive method, just with the chamber that is allowing to see the impedance factors and permeability of the ferrite at different temperature levels. So on the picture you see the typical HP device lying horizontally with the micrometer, and somebody's okay, and that micrometer actually is pushing one of the electrodes that is made as in form of the disc, and then you could put, let's say, the ferrite or whatever the material will have in between, and just simply put the micrometer very tight on it. Although one of the methods that is being done at the same device is non-contacting method. And then you see on the other picture, the one that is made by a different company, and you see another picture below, and then set of big pictures, those are for the competition, which is the TA instrument. Now, the good thing about the TA instrument is that you're dealing with kind of a enclosure that keeps the temperature from 190 degrees minus of centigrade up to 600 degrees of Celsius. I mean, you can describe what you see on the pictures and some information there underneath of it. Back to you, Dick.
saying that this machine measures dielectric constant of maybe ferrite materials. I've never seen this machine. I've never used one of these things. Don't know if I've got any smarts on this one. So is it ferrite materials that you're measuring the dielectric constant of with these two oven-like things? In other words, you can adjust the temperature. You probably calibrate it first by putting those, in the very first picture, you put those two plates a known distance apart and measure the capacitance between the two plates. Then you put your material in there and measure the change in capacitance, and that tells you something about the dielectric properties of your material. And if you now do that at various temperatures, I guess each individual material has a certain temperature coefficient of dielectric constant, is what I think you were saying here. And I'm not quite sure what the question is, but I've never used this machine. Over to you, Wes.
Yeah, and to extend. Well, the thing is that the impedance is being measured with respect to the impedance of the air. So when on the HP picture, you put the material in between kind of vise, which are two parallel plates, they are actually plates of the capacitor, then you are able to measure all of the parameters of the impedance, and that would be the permittivity, loss tangent, permeability. Now, you can put any material you want to, as long as no more than 10 millimeters thick. And this first device that you see on the picture is not really made for different temperature. It's not an oven. It's the one that I'm acquiring right now, and it's for my 4194A impedance gain phase analyzer. Let me drop. For somebody messing up right now with the frequency, I can tell. I have 100 watts of power. I can put 300 watts right now. I just don't want to do it. Your action is simply hopeless. You simply don't have the power. Excuse me for that comment. N2XGN. Okay. So, now, when you look at that a second picture right below that, this is a one company device. And the third picture that is on it, and this stuff is made for the temperature-controlled measurement of the impedance factors, or the electric factors. Now, another one, which is the set of the big pictures, is the TA instrument, and this one is really the Rolls-Royce. Let me jump. And what it does is, it has the kind of enclosure, a housing made of glass. Now you can put the helium cooling on it, and then you can see how the magnetic properties of the material, or the magnet, or the ferrite, that's what I'm hunting for. Now it could be that. He's up. Mechanical stress is placed by alternating voltage across the sample in between the sandwich, and alternating strain becomes stored charge Q in the sample. So the sample is, in effect, behaves a simple capacitor. DETA or DEA, dielectric analysis, offers a sensitivity for direction and monitoring of certain types of transition in appropriate samples. So you can have a low thermal mass assembly. You can have high efficient and fast cooling available. You can have a temperature start from 190 degrees minus. And you can have not only solid materials, but you can play with it with liquids and powders. So it's just the another interesting technology. Back to you.
The main thing that I'm seeing curve and the yellow dotted response curve, notice that there is a phase shift between the two. The amplitude tells you something about dielectric constant, and the phase shift is telling you something about power factor or loss tangents. In other words, every dielectric material has an equivalent amount of capacitance, an equivalent amount of resistance, loss resistance. And so that response curve, the phase shift on the curve, and the amplitude of the curve is giving you a lot of information all at once. So when you measure the dielectric properties of materials and you get that response curve, and now you record the change of the response curve as a function of temperature, you're really measuring whether or not the dielectric constant and loss tangent changes as a function of temperature. So that's what I think this thing is intended to do. That's what I think that curve is telling us.
Thank you. When you look at the lower pictures, simultaneous DMA and DEA analysis, it is made on the same concept, and then another picture I would like you to explain, which starts from the green. What does the dynamic mechanical analyzer measure? And you see the picture on the wooden table of an analyzer, and then on the need of it you see something like a graph of the same analyzer, and then lower at that you see the sinusoidal graph of the excitation input amplitude and the response output and phase. Now, if you just could quickly concentrate on that part and say what you understand from that cutoff of the device that shows the internal the components of that device. Thank you.
The blue excitation curve does say input voltage, and the response yellow dotted curve has an amplitude and a phase shift to it, a delta phase. And so when you look at the picture down below, DEA, excitation, and response, you've got the plus and minus dielectric of a particular grain, molecule, crystal, I'm not sure what, and very similar to what happens in a microwave oven. The individual water molecules are a polar molecule, and at the 2.45 gigahertz of input signal to your microwave oven, those water molecules attempt to flip back and forth at that rate, but they don't succeed. They always do it with a phase lag. They've got mass, and they've got the resistance, so to speak. And that hysteresis loss is the mechanism by which the water becomes heated by the microwaves. And so dielectric materials, solid materials or liquid materials, have a similar response. And so this apparatus is allowing to measure those responses as a function of temperature. Some of the words you use made it sound like they're also mechanically exciting the device under test. I don't think so. Well, maybe so. Maybe there's a mechanical piston here being moved, but I think the main thing that's going on is you're measuring the electrical performance as a function of frequency of excitation and also temperature that the material is being suspended at, held at, during the measurement. And you're measuring the dielectric constant, the what do they call it now? E prime and E double prime, the lossy part and the non-lossy.
Repeater, time out.
So is I correct in assuming that this is only electrical performance? There is no simultaneous mechanical excitation taking place during these measurements?
They have both the DMA and DEA. DMA stands for the direct mechanical analysis, and DEA stands for dielectric. DMA stands for dielectric mechanical analysis, and DEA stands for dielectric analysis by itself. but because we don't have much time, I would like to move to the oscillators. I have interesting subject, why the direct impedance method is better than other methods, and then I have Hong Kong University link material underneath of that, but it takes a little bit more time. Oscillators is easy. On the point four, can you believe that? Okay. On point four, the oscillators, is, you see two pictures. One next to the other, one says 100 kilohertz and the other one says 8 kilohertz. My question is, how low crystal oscillator can go with the frequency back to you?
I don't know. Because it is a piezoelectric mechanical device, if you're willing to build it big enough, I think you could make a crystal oscillator run at 100 hertz if you wanted to. I don't know if you'd be able to easily put it in a convenient size package, but it's a quartz crystal oscillator is a mechanical deflecting device because of the voltage you apply to it and the piezoelectric effect. So size is wavelength. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, the next question that I have is the size you need from 1 to 200 megahertz. Now, this device is on sale on eBay, and it has a tag with the question marks on it. It's a CMOS or TTL. Now, my question is, how does it work? It's one chip.
Hey, you could have a basic oscillator in there at some particular frequency, like 100 megacycles or 10 megacycles, and in order to get another frequency, it's rather easy within the chip, within the integrated circuit, to have a bucket brigade frequency divide circuit, a shift register-like thing that's doing frequency division. So one convenient way to do it, to get, let me pick a number, if you wanted a 10 kilohertz oscillator, if you did it with a pure piece of quartz, it would be a very large object. To run it at a much, much higher frequency with a frequency dividing circuit inside would allow you to build a very small package, 10 kilohertz oscillator, with very high accuracy. Over to you.
Oh. On C point, you have a 3A725B military gas, GAAS gun oscillator diode at 8.25 gigahertz. Now what you see over there is a diode. Could you explain how it works? And underneath of it you have parameters. It says Russian 3A725V military gas gun oscillator.
It sounds like somebody wants to join us. Who was that? Okay, a gun oscillator is a so-called bulk effect device. The bulk effect device really means that you put a significantly high voltage across the diode. It requires a very good heat sink on the diode, otherwise it would burn up real fast. But you put a lot of current or a lot of voltage across the diode, and if the diode is made the correct way, there's a kind of sheet of current that flows across the diode, and it takes a certain transit time to do that. And you put that diode inside of a resonant circuit. It's a very simple diode in a resonant circuit, forward biased. And when you bias it forwardly with the right amount of current, the curve of current versus voltage has a U-shaped curve to it. It's got a negative impedance region. And once you get the bulk effect diode in the right amount of forward current, so it's in the negative impedance region, it then will automatically oscillate. So gun diodes are really just a resonator with a diode properly heat sunk, and the diode has the right kind of transit time of the current that flows across the diode. That's a little bit about what a gun diode is. I guarantee if you Google the word gun diode, you'll get a lot more information than I've given you. Over to you, Wes.
Okay. Point D. You see the picture of the waveguide with the active element in it, and the question is, this is a X-band cavity oscillator waveguide by C 6K systems. My question to you is, why that active element is not on the center?
As you move an object from the center to the edge of a waveguide to coax adapter, you are adjusting the impedance that you see. The impedance goes to zero at the left-hand vertical edge and the right-hand vertical edge. The highest possible impedance is in the center. So by being off to one side, you're adjusting the impedance the gun diode sees. That's one factor. Second of all, one of those rods in that thing that you're looking at, the X-band cavity oscillator waveguide thing, that's really called a gun plexer. That thing is a transmitter receiver. That assembly is used in the police radar gun that runs that X-band. So that rod is magnetically biased. It is a kind of a circulator to help you keep separate the signal that's being transmitted by the gun diode versus the signal that's being received. And the signal being received, because the Doppler is very slightly different in frequency, the circulator helps you keep the outgoing signal and the ingoing signal slightly separated from each other. So the two mix together in a diode that's also hung in that waveguide, and the diode becomes the mixer that gives you a video output, which is the Doppler frequency in front of that police radar gun. That is the basic mechanism of a police radar gun. Over to you, Wes.
Okay, I'm skipping a few points because we don't have much time. I go to the point F, like Frank. Watkins, Johnson, backward wave oscillator. Now, I put three of different backward wave oscillators from different manufacturers on it. What is backward wave oscillator?
KJ4ILK, you have something you want to tell us? Go ahead. Okay, somebody signed in twice. Backward wave oscillator, one of the ways of building one of those is it's basically a kind of a traveling wave tube with a helix, and ordinarily the signal flowing down the helix in the forward direction gives you some gain, but if there is a high impedance or a short circuit at one end of the helix, the signal flows back, and you have an oscillator. It's rather easy to make a traveling wave tube into an oscillator. They have to work very hard to stop that from happening. We're really basically out of time. The machine's about to be cut off. This was TechNet number 1361, and we'll be back next week. So, 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Thank you very much. Have a good one. Thank you for your help. Thank you, everybody, for listening. John, pick up.
Good night, everybody. Good night, Dick, Mel. I talked to you not a lot. Thanks very much.
The time is 1 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Next tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
KJ4ILK.
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 The time is 1:23 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
K-E-T-T-U-Y disconnected.
Next tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater. Next tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.
connected. K J 6 T Z J K J 6 T Z J disconnected.
Set tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Set tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.